It's time now for our ongoing series discussing substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium.
I'm Selena Meekum. I'm with Willapa Behavioral Health. I'm the interim CEO as well as the SUD program manager.
My name's Troy Acord. I am with Willapa as well. I am a SUD counselor as well as a DV perpetrator treatment provider.
I'm Natalie Holtman, and I'm also with Willapa Behavioral Health, and I am a substance use disorder and mental health peer support specialist.
There was a big push in regards to doctors and prescribing opioids. OxyContin is one that pops to mind.
Yes.
There was an overabundance of prescriptions that were put out for that. And all of a sudden, it came around to hold it. These people are not on the Oxy anymore, but now they've gone to heroin because they can't get the Oxy because the prescription's out.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And has that turned around?
Yes.
Good.
It's a work in progress.
Okay.
How's that? So they've recognized the problem and they're starting to turn it around. Basically, what it was is we were in a place in society where it's like, oh my gosh, you feel pain? That's not okay. Let's get you fixed up right now. We'll go ahead and take away all your pain. And then they realize, like, oh, taking away all of a person's pain can cause problems. So now they're moving into a model of pain management where it's like, you know what? This is your body. This is natural. Sometimes it will feel pain. We're going to teach you how to manage that pain. And so rather than, like, pumping them up on opiates, they try to do more of a pain management style versus a, like, let's cover up that pain sort of mentality. And I think that also goes, I think, mental health as well, because mental health is a big part of substance use,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
in my opinion. And I think that's kind of, we're going through that sort of phase right now with mental health. It's like a step behind where we have been trying to, like, this generation has been trying to stop their kids from feeling any sort of pain at all. It's like,
no
boo-boos. You're okay. It's okay. Everything's fine. Here, have a sucker. Here, you get a trophy, even though you lost.
Everybody
here's your trophy.
Gets a trophy. Yeah.
And so
exactly.
Then what that's causing is an issue where no one has tolerance for pain at all anymore. They cannot sit with the fact, like, oh my gosh, I lost. I failed. They don't see failure as an opportunity of growth. They see it as just like, this is it. Like, I'm worth nothing anymore. And so then we've kind of gotten to this place in society where we recognize, like, okay, so taking away people's mental pain is also not helpful. Like, pain can be productive. It's telling you something. It's giving you a message that something needs to change, and it's important to be able to hear that message and not muffle it. And so hopefully with mental health as well, we're trying to move into the phase of, like, let's teach you how to manage your pain. Let's teach you how to look at those demons and face them, give them a name, because something that has a name, it takes the steam out of it. It allows you to know what it is you're dealing with. And so we are trying to help that progress along. Some doctors are slower than others to it. Some doctors are really fast at it. It just depends on what the patient needs.
In the Marine Corps, they always told us that pain reminds you you're alive.
Yep.
Right. There you go. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Depending upon the type of pain, though. If your pain is getting you to use, then does that mean you're alive?
Well, because of the participation trophy mentality, people don't have any concept of what it's like not to be told, oh, well, you're still a winner because you showed up. And then when they have walls and doors slammed in their face as they get older, it's so overwhelming because, how am I supposed to function now? What
am I supposed to get a trophy? Yeah.
Mm-hmm. There's an excellent book. It's The Subtle Art of Not Giving an F. And it has, like, little asterisks and stuff.
Right,
that, whatever.
Right.
But it addresses that issue, and I really appreciate it because it talks about how we've gotten to the point where we can't tolerate if we fail. Like, failure's not an option. And it talks about, like, you know what? Sometimes you're not going to be great that day.
Right.
You're actually going to be a piece of crap. And that's okay. Like, live with it. Sit with it. You didn't do well today. Just know that and then move on and try to do better tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. But we are raising a whole community that isn't going to feel that way.
This is true. This is true.
And what does that bode for the future then? Are we,
terrifying.
See, that's
that's
why community is important. And that's why the concept of trying to, anybody you come in contact with, trying to, I don't know, teach them in that moment of time, like, that who they are is okay, who they are is acceptable. Be curious instead of offended. I think that is one of the best things society could ever do for itself, would be to be curious instead of getting offended, like with substance use and people who are stuck in that addiction cycle. Be curious about that person's story. Be curious about what they need. Call them by name instead of being offended by that addict over there. Like, go check on Tom. See how Tom's doing today. Is he ready to make a change? If not, just let him know we're here when he needs help.
Well, and I tell my clients all the time, you will come in contact with people that might be rude, disrespectful, angry. You know, you could be standing in the grocery line and somebody gets in line behind you and they're pushing and they're rude and they're saying terrible things. But the problem is you have no idea how they got to that place. People are not born rude. People are not born disrespectful. You know, what happens if that guy just found out his wife has cancer or, you know, his dog just got run over, right? Whatever it might be, you don't know. And so, like Selena said, finding out how they got there is so important. And people that have, you know, growing up in the mentality that an addict is a terrible thing and they're lesser than, and along the lines of some days you just don't do well, if people don't respond well or they're trying to change their thought process and their mentality about that, and one day they have the thought or they say something that's insensitive towards the recovery community, that doesn't mean give up. You know, it doesn't mean give up. You do better next time.
Mm-hmm. Struggles are opportunities to grow.
Yeah.
Every time.
Absolutely.
Struggles are opportunities to grow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of kids don't hear that nowadays.
Nope.
And, yeah, interesting. Are we raising a bunch of addicts in the future? It's going to be, when they get the door slammed in their face too many times, is that going to be the go-to?
So there's actually a study that was done. It's called the ACEs study, and it was Kaiser Permanente. It's a long-term study that basically looked into your events as a child, how they affect you as an adult, and someone who has a higher ACEs score is much more likely to fall into substance use disorder, to be victimized, and to run into criminal issues and to have all these problems. And the things that they were measuring is the trauma that you experienced in your childhood, like did your parents yell at you, did you get spanked, kind of thing. Like spanking and yelling,
witness domestic violence.
All parents do that. I'm saying like out of control stuff where it is just ridiculous.
You're not spanking your child, you're beating on your child.
Yeah, okay. And witnessing domestic violence or witnessing something bad happen in the community. All of those raise your chances of having a substance use disorder. The most important thing is to teach a child about resilience and to teach anyone. Adults learn about resilience every day. The thing that helps keep pulling people back from that edge is learning about resilience. And resilience is your ability to pop back when something bad happens. It's your ability to like shake it off and be like, okay, that was rough. I'm going to have my moment to experience my feelings and to go through them, and then I'm going to be okay, and I'm going to keep moving forward. When someone is traumatized by something, it's because that event or what they heard or whatever it is outran their capability to be able to cope with it and be resilient, and so that gets stuck, and they're not able to move past that. And when you have something that's stuck in there that is traumatizing, it will keep forcing its way back in. That's part of post-traumatic stress disorder, is it keeps forcing its way back in. You're not inviting it, you're not trying to like have it, but it is there. It is in your dreams, it's in the smells, it's in the sounds around you. Mm-hmm. And that gets so hard to just sit with in your head. If you can imagine like the worst feelings and thoughts you've ever had in a day, and like they're there constantly and on blast 24/7 in your head, like think about how a person must feel, and all they're trying to do is quiet that, like when they use some sort of substance or when they drink to excess. And what substance use is just, sometimes it's someone trying to have fun. Yes, there's that crowd of people, but oftentimes, at least the people that we see, it's about trauma. It's about trying to like quiet the demons just long enough so they can breathe and they can feel a sense of safe and normal. Normal is the biggest word they use. They just want to feel normal. And substance use, when they get high, allows them that one moment, because any other time in their life, in society, in their community, they do not feel normal.
I call it the merry-go-round, because people will get high, and then they'll feel guilty about getting high. So they'll get high so they don't have to feel guilty, but then they feel guilty so they get high, and it just goes around and around and around trying not to feel bad. But then you do the thing that makes you feel bad, and it goes around and around and around. And when you, when somebody goes through those trauma, like I said earlier, I don't think I have ever had a client that didn't have some trauma in the back in the background. And if they, the resilience, if they don't have anywhere to reach out and get support, and they have to do it all within themselves, can be extra difficult. And if the community is pushing them away on top of it.
If no one models for them how to be resilient, no one encourages them to be resilient, how are they expected to know how to do that?
Especially when we sit there and say, well, you're one of those people.
Yes, exactly.
And instead of you are.
Yeah, you are nothing but an addict. Okay, so where does resilience come into that? Like, how are addicts resilient?
How do I jump back from that?
Exactly.
You're just an addict, you know. Mm-hmm. That's not something to feel.
Yeah, and with... by not using people's names, by referring to them as their disorder rather than their name, it allows you to be unkind to them. It allows you to do things you wouldn't normally do against them. Like, I'm not comparing like society's reaction to substance use as like Nazi times. However, this is, I feel it's a very clear thing that most people know about, so they'll be able to see, like Nazi Germany times, they didn't use the prisoners' names. They stamped little numbers on their arms, and that's how they kept a hold of them and like figured out where they were and kept track. And it dehumanized them, and it allowed them to be treated any way a person felt, because they were no longer a human. They were just like an object that was to be used as a tool or whatever it was. And so when we don't use people's names and we stamp them with whatever brand we feel like is appropriate for however gross we feel they are, that takes away their humanity. And then that gives people, I'm using air quotes with my finger, the right, it gives people the right to mistreat them and treat them like they're less, and to just exclude them from everything, exclude them from everything they need to actually get better.
We talk a lot about opioids and methamphetamines and the such. Alcohol is a problem too.
Alcohol's a big problem.
I mean,
a lot of our domestic violence situations happen.
That drunk guy down at the end of the bar.
Yep.
He's here every night. That guy.
Yeah.
Alcohol kills significantly more people every year than all of the other drugs combined.
And it is far more dangerous to withdraw from.
Oh, absolutely.
Than most of the other drugs, benzos as well. But
it's one of the few that is, can kill you just coming
absolutely.
Down. Coming off long-term alcohol.
Well, I'd heard that about opioids.
Opioids will make you feel like you want to die.
You
but
wish
generally speaking, you're not going to die from opiate use. Mm-hmm. So methamphetamines and opiates, you won't die from them. Opiates, you'll feel like, you won't die from withdrawal, but your body will feel like it. It will revolt against you. It'll be like your body is turning itself inside out and then trying to do an origami. And so,
exactly.
So, but you won't die from those. It's benzos and alcohol that are dangerous to withdraw from, because you can go into seizures and you can die. And so you want to be very careful how you detox from those things and get medical support, because your body gets used to it. It makes it part of its ecosystem. Even though it's a very unhealthy part of the ecosystem, it still makes it part of its ecosystem. So when you yank that part, your body is like, what do we do here? It's like, okay, the bees are dying in the world, and so we're concerned about our ecosystem because it could die because it's missing a part of it. Our bodies kind of react the same way. So
because it's missing that
piece that we we built into it.
Right.
And I gotta say, when with the years I've been doing this, and myself included, I have seen addicts, and I'll use myself as the example. I was in active addiction for 20 years, and I am a couple quarters away from getting my master's now, and I got 9 credits in high school. Like,
go team!
I was not the super student.
You get a trophy.
You know, get a trophy.
But I'm really close. Right, exactly. But I'm so close. But I can, and I've seen that done by thousands of different addicts. They get clean. Their brain begins to rejuvenate. I just took a class on the ability for the brain to rejuvenate. The only ones that I've seen that don't rejuvenate and don't come back are the long-term chronic alcohol users, because it does so much damage to the brain. and it's really sad. It's referred to as wet brain, and they don't come back, and it
causes cognitive issues. Like, your ability to act as a normal person is gone. Like, you'll never get yourself back after you hit wet brain status.
I almost think it's like they revert back to, like, a 12-year-old's mentality.
Yeah, kind of childlike.
And angry. They're always angry.
And the same thing, I don't think people, because things are considered socially acceptable. Like, alcohol is considered socially acceptable. You have it at soirees and dinner, and it's fine if it's within balance. Like, if you have one drink, possibly two, depending on your body weight and your gender kind of thing. But after that, it goes into a place that is starting to go into misuse or, like, danger zone. Same thing with cannabis. Like, cannabis is everywhere, and I cannot tell you how many clients are like, no, cannabis is great. It's going to save the world. It's going to save me. It heals everything. I love it. And it causes just as many – it can cause as many problems, too. It causes cognitive issues. There are studies that show that long-term use will lead to cognitive decline, meaning that you're not going to have as good of a memory. Your processing is going to be a lot slower. And you're going to have all these side effects. And so, and people who use marijuana oftentimes are called potheads. And sometimes we joke about it. However, like, any movie you watch, like with high school, they've got a section that's the pothead section, right? Mm-hmm. They're isolated from the rest of the people. Parents don't like them. Most kids don't necessarily play with them. They think, huh, yeah, sure, they're fine, whatever. But they're isolated over there. And so I think each substance, even though it might be socially acceptable and when used in moderation, can have good effects. Like, a lot of things have a place and a time. It's when people overuse them and misuse them that it starts to become an issue. And so I think that when we overuse them and then we start to separate people from the pack and say, oh, they're a pothead, they're an alcoholic, they're a meth head, they're this, they're that, then it takes away the sense of community, which is really, I think, what life is kind of about.
Mm-hmm. Ironically, this is pre-recorded, ladies and gentlemen, and ironically, we are doing it on 420.
Are we really?
It is 420.
It absolutely
it is.
You're
right. Well.
And since we were talking about the social stigmas, that used to be a social stigma, marijuana, now it is legal in this state.
Yes.
Oregon is moving towards legalizing all drugs. What about this legalization?
Woo! Okay, pros and there are pros and cons. I see where they could be coming from on one side. However, the consequences of it are very, very concerning. In the perfect world.
Which we do not have.
Which we do not have. Yeah, Troy.
I have very strong opinions about this. And the worldwide, if you look at the way that other countries have endeavored to work through this problem, there is basis, historical and factual basis. A great example is Portugal. They had one of the highest overdose death rates in the world. Mm-hmm. And they were following, you know, our system of punitive incarceration, and it just was not working. The death rates continued to grow. So they did legalize all of them. But what they did was take all that money that they had been using for incarceration, which is ridiculously high, mm-hmm. you know, anywhere from $35,000 to $90,000 a year per inmate, mm-hmm. and they took all that money that they had been spending, and they created job opportunities. They, you know, Bob wants to be a mechanic, so they go down to Tom's mechanic shop, and they say, well, we'll pay half of his salary for the first year. And now he has a job and a reason to look forward to the future and a reason to think, oh, this is why I'm getting up today. And they offered rehabilitation, and they offered, you know, teaching them how to have a budget and keep their money and how to have family therapy so that they can interact healthy with their family. And they took all that money and put it into actually
treatment,
you know, treatment
help.
And legitimate help
resources.
To move forward and resources. And so if, you know, like if Oregon legalizes everything, mm-hmm. but they don't put that money back into helping them, it's pointless, and it will end up causing problems.
If you there's like a thousand ways to approach a situation. I think the culture of a society is really important to consider, like the work ethic behind a society, because sometimes when you just give things to people, they don't appreciate the value of what's in front of them, and it's misused. Others, like, completely appreciate that and will take it and will make it grow 1,000 times. So those things need to be considered, and it needs to be, like, a well-thought-out process of, okay, so if we don't have this kind of system in place, what system will we have? Because it has potential to be a good thing, but it also has a potential to be a chaotic thing. You have to do it with such care and put structure and boundaries in place. Like, simply saying, well, they decriminalized it, and so there weren't as many people in jail. Okay, there weren't as many people in jail because they weren't able to make their arrest. It doesn't mean bad things weren't happening. It just means they weren't considered illegal. And so having a good structure in place where you've got a plan for what you're going to do, and you have a lot of education that's going on so people can make informed decisions when they're little before they start, because a lot of people start substance use in their younger years. They need to understand what it's going to do, and sometimes you just, no matter how much you tell a kid, it just doesn't matter. But
kids are kids.
Yeah.
And if you don't put those resources in place before you do something like decriminalization, what are they going to do? I mean, you know, it's like, oh, wow, it's a party because there's no consequences, but there's no resources to do anything about it either.
Join us next Monday morning at 8:40 a.m. for our continuing discussion on substance use disorder as a treatable disease, brought to you by the Grays Harbor Consortium, exclusively on 103.5 FM and 1450 a.m. KBKW. To hear archived discussions, log on to gograysharbor.com.